Hey, Startup Hustle listeners, before we get into today's episode, I've got some exciting news to share. If you've enjoyed the insights and stories here at Startup Hustle, you're going to love what we have in store at our brand new podcast called Product Driven. I've always described myself as a product guy first, entrepreneur, software engineer, but really a product guy. I love building products. Many people struggle, though, with how to take a product idea and build a tech product, while software engineers struggle to understand the business side of things and they just don't see the big picture. My new podcast, Product Driven, is about that gap between business and the tech side of building software. It's designed for startup founders, tech leaders, software engineers, and anyone who loves tech and startups. Thank you for being part of this community. Enjoy this episode of Startup Hustle, and please subscribe to Product Driven in your podcast app, and you can also check it out on YouTube. Thank you so much.
And we're back for another episode of Startup Hustle, a podcast for entrepreneurs by entrepreneurs. If you want to start, own, or build a business, then you're in the right place. We bring you the real truth about what it's like to take something from concept to launch. From growth, innovation, experience, failing, or winning big, we've got you covered. So let's get down to business with another episode of Startup Hustle, brought to you by Fullscale.io.
And we're back with another episode of the Startup Hustle. This is your host today, Matt Watson. Very excited to be joined today by Ted Blosser from WorkRamp. His company has a learning management system. We're going to learn all about his business and the trials and tribulations. Before the episode, we were talking about some really cool talking points today, so I'm on the edge of my seat to hear what he has to say. Before we get started, I do want to remind everybody that today's episode of Startup Hustle is powered by Fullscale.io. Hiring software developers is difficult. Fullscale can help you build a software team quickly and affordably and has the platform to help you manage that team. Visit Fullscale.io to learn more. Ted, welcome to the show, man.
Matt, thanks for having me. Excited to be here.
Since you're a founder of a company that builds a learning management system, I think we're all going to learn something today, right? I mean, that has to be...
It's as advertised. Yes. Hopefully I could share some great knowledge.
If anybody knows how to teach somebody something, it's got to be you. So to get us started today, why don't you tell us a little bit about your background and then how you, eventually become to start WorkRamp?
Yeah, for sure. Maybe I'll start. I won't go all the way back to my childhood. I'll start my professional career.
Preschool. Preschool is even better. No, I'm just kidding.
I could go all the way back there. Might be a 3-hour podcast though. But professionally, started my career out at Cisco doing sales, went to Santa Clara University. I have a funny story about how I just landed in sales randomly at the career fair, but I won't go too far into that. But started Cisco, learned the ropes of selling. Then I actually tried my own first startup, failed miserably. I was a wantrepreneur at that time. Then I said, hey, I need to go learn how to actually build a real startup and learn from the best part of this learning journey. So I joined Box back in 2011 under the leadership of Aaron Levy, if you've heard of him, which was just a great experience. Spent 5 years there, learned the ins and outs of SaaS, met my co-founder there. And when I felt like I was ready, I always knew I wanted to do another startup because I love the entrepreneurial journey. I jumped ship at the end of 2015, started WorkRamp, and happy to share all the trials and tribulations and wins and losses we've gone through over the last 7 years on this fun startup journey ever since.
If I remember right, one of the founders of Box is actually from Kansas City.
Oh, yeah. Wait, which one? Do you know the name?
I don't remember. Okay. I should know this, but...
Got it.
Yeah, there. I think there's a Kansas City twist there for our Kansas City fans. But so tell us what led you to start WorkRamp? Like why build a learning management system? What was the genesis of that?
For sure. And actually,
and I guess maybe we should start with what the hell is a learning management system?
I'll start there first, and then I'll go into how we stumbled into this category. So a learning management system is almost exactly what it sounds like. It's one of the core infrastructure categories and software. It's been around for 20, 30 years, and it essentially helps manage learning within an organization. So a company learns in many different ways. It might be ranging from things like security training to compliance training, all the way to sales training, all the way to helping your customers and partners learn. And we're the underlying infrastructure to actually run all those programs. And that's the learning management system category. And this category has been around on-premise all the way to now. It's obviously predominantly cloud. And I would say we're one of the leading providers of LMS software for the mid-market and SMB category. So that's kind of where we sit.
Well, and there's and so I've actually known a few companies that are kind of in that space. And so, for example, just so people understand other use cases of this, one of them is a local company here in Kansas City that does like training for nurses, like, and the nurses have to go through this training and do testing and all this stuff. And they have like a proprietary like learning management system or whatever. And when I think of learning management system, I also think of like, I signed up for some dude's courses on how to trade crypto, which I failed miserably at. But like, you know, I use like some kind of learning management system to go through all of the training or whatever, right? Like there's a lot of different use cases for this kind of product is kind of the point.
Yep, that's exactly right. And that's more on the consumer or prosumer, yeah, prosumer lens. And we focus on B2B, but you're totally right. It's the same concept. Hopefully you didn't deposit into FTX there, maybe stayed on Binance. But we definitely do a similar thing, but at the corporate level. Yeah, which in my mind, a lot easier to do.
Yeah, oh yeah, for sure. So what was the genesis of building an LMS? Like, were there none that existed? Or, you know, how did you figure out your niche here?
There were 600 competitors. And so it's crazy to think there when you're doing market analysis. But I would say our story is a little bit more like when I heard the story of Jeff Lawson at Twilio. And Jeff Lawson was looking for a startup to start. And that was similar to us, where we had two criteria in mind. Me and my co-founder, Arsh Mund, we said, look, we want a very large category that was undisrupted, that we can make a difference in. And two, our other criteria for starting the startup is we want to build a great company that really reflected the culture we wanted to have. And so for that first one was, we looked at the learning management system category. Again, 600 competitors, but they were all pretty bad. And the category is almost infinite from the standpoint of, hey, anyone who is working needs to learn and train for their job, right? And so we said, hey, that fits our criteria. Crappy competitors, it's a huge market and we can make a difference in. And then that second criteria was that, hey, let's go be thoughtful about what's the company we like to build. Because when we came from our previous company, Box, the one thing we learned there is that people enjoyed working there, not because they had a love for file sharing, right? They loved it because it's just a great company and culture to show up at every day. And so we thought that was a big part of, hey, we want to go do this for the next couple decades in our life. Let's go start a great company around that first point, which is the category and the problem we want to solve.
So when you were looking at the category, you know, you mentioned there's potentially 600 competitors or whatever it is. Like, I think that's a good point for people to understand, because usually in most markets, there's two or three. Right? You have like Slack or Teams, you have Coke or Pepsi or whatever, right? Like in a lot of different verticals. And if it's highly fragmented, where nobody has more than 1% of the market share or 5% of the market share, there is potential for somebody to come in and maybe do it better than everybody else. And that was the opportunity that you were keen on.
Yeah, that's totally right. And we actually wanted to use, the resources we had to our competitive advantage. If you, the Tristan Walker, I forgot his company name. He did the consumer product goods company that sold to P&G, but he gave this really good example of like, hey, when you're starting a startup, do things that you have a competitive advantage on. And what we had a competitive advantage on is we thought, hey, we could raise venture capital. Most of those 600 competitors did not raise venture capital. And we could, at the time, hire really good Silicon Valley talent. And then lastly, Arsh and I knew SaaS really well because we just came from Box, right? And so we said, you know what? Looking at those 600 competitors, most of them were kind of mom and pop SaaS companies, legacy providers doing it as a lifestyle business. Very few of them had actually raised venture capital and said, hey, I could go build a high growth company around this. And very few of them were actually based in Silicon Valley. And so we said, hey, let's take those competitive differentiators, package them up, and let that be a differentiator into launching the market. And it took some time, But once we did that and we got a bunch of marquee customers on board, then it started to snowball into a successful company.
So why did you think early on that you'd be able to raise VC money where most, you know, your competition hadn't? Like what gave you that?
Yeah. You know, it's funny that there's a nice nuance that even though I did say, hey, I thought we could raise it. So we were overconfident we could raise it heading into starting the company. We're like, oh yeah, we're in Silicon Valley. We came from Box. We think we're awesome, right? And right. what was really funny is it was a sobering experience when we actually went on the fundraising trail to start. We got so many no's. Like we got dozens and dozens of no's out of the gate, and we literally stopped fundraising because I was like, I don't think I could get this done. And so actually our initial hypothesis was wrong, but we then luckily get into Y Combinator, you know, the Harvard right. of startup accelerators. And no joke, once people heard we got in, like the day after we got in, all those investors that were saying no came back kind of banging at the door saying, hey, how can we invest? It's kind of funny how much air now, cover a program like that can give.
Yeah. Now the herd feels like it's safe all of a sudden, you know, that yes. So you didn't even have to finish Y Combinator. It's like just as soon as you started.
Literally got in, we got cold called. Like we had a really well-known investor, Semel Shah from Haystack, just cold called and he's known for just kind of finding startups almost out of thin air, and he has a great track record. Like he did Figma as an example recently. He did Hopin and a few others. But he basically cold called us on our support line, like, hey, I heard you got into YC. Tell me more about this. And he's one of our earliest investors.
So before you joined YC, did you guys already have the product in the market and had customers and all that kind of stuff? Or like, where were you in the stage?
Yeah, for sure. I'll rewind back a little bit. So we started WorkRamp in late 2015. I remember the date. September 22nd is when we incorporated. And we essentially spent a good 6 months getting our first few reference clients. I would call it about 5 to 10 customers using the platform. When I talked about not being able to raise, that was about 3 months in. We had a couple clients. Okay. About 3 months in, I was like, hey, I think I could go raise on this. I think we were about 50K ARR at the time. And that's when I went to pound the pavement and just no luck. And then we applied to YC that spring and ended up getting into YC that spring. And the class started, I think, in the beginning of June. And once we got in, we were roughly, I think, about 70, 80K ARR, grew a little bit. And then we're kind of off to the races in terms of fundraising, going through YC and really getting into the harder part of our startup journey. But we were able to take that momentum with YC and use it to raise our first seed round of $2.2 million.
So how hard was it to get into YC? Because I would think for the same reason that all the investors said no, YC would potentially say no on even letting you in, right? So how was the journey of actually like getting into Y Combinator?
Oh man, that's such a great story. So I was kind of stubborn about YC. You know, I was a little bit older at the time. I was 31. Now I'm in my late 30s. And I told my co-founder, Arsh, I was like, I just feel like we're too old. I have a kid. Like these are all young 20-somethings. Like it's probably not for us. And he's like, you know what, Ted, let's just apply. So like the night before the applications were due, and I'd been rejected from YC maybe 2 or 3 times earlier in my life. I can't even keep count. And so I was just like, it's just not even worth it. So he talked me into submitting an application. He's like, I'll write it. So he writes it himself. Probably a pro tip, have the CTO write it because the CEO adds too much fluff.
Yeah.
And so he writes the application. And the funny part of the story was we record the video, the mandatory video you have to record. It's a 1-minute YouTube video you have to record. And when we were recording, we're like, this just doesn't seem like cool enough or enough hype. And LMS sounds really boring. And so we're like, you know what? Let's just say we have AI in the platform. And so,
oh, no.
So we knew nothing about AI. We're like, you know what? Let's just toss in AI. And so we were like, hey, we're the first AI-based LMS on the market. So we make it all up. We get the interview. And so my co-founder is freaking out. He's like, oh, crap, they're going to ask me about AI. So he spends like 2 weeks building a prototype night and day. And he actually has a working prototype that feels like AI. and he gets it working, and we get into the actual interview. They didn't ask us anything about AI. They didn't even ask us to demo it. So my co-founder is tired and like could barely stay awake, but we end up nailing the interview and getting in. So that was a fun story. Getting in was totally unexpected.
So does the product have any kind of AI in it today, like leftover from that?
You know, it's funny. Now with ChatGPT, we might need to put that in there, but I've had a few vendors actually pitch us on putting in ChatGPT into it. But we don't have like any official AI, but I do see it. I mean, to be honest, I do see it coming down the pike in 2 to 3 years, actually, into the product. I think there's a lot of cool use cases, mostly because our platform is a heavy content creation platform too. So there's some really neat stuff you could do. But at that time in 2016, OpenAI was not really, I don't even know if they're around at that time. So
you mentioned the use cases. So we've talked, you know, about the learning management system and stuff like that, but I think it'd be great to hear a little more detail on, you know, a case study of like one of your customers that uses the product and how they use it, how it benefits them, just so people have a better idea of, you know, who your target customer is and stuff.
Yeah, for sure. So I'll talk through a couple case studies. One, let's talk on the customer education side. So on the customer education side, so this is like a SaaS company training their own customers. We have a customer called Quantum Metric. Quantum Metric has the ability to, in their product, if you look at a lot of those dropdowns, you would have like a help site, you would have your area for you to submit support tickets, and then you have an academy or a university. When you click into that, the user expects to learn more about Quantum Metric. When they click into that, they actually get landed onto a hosted page, basically a white label page on Quantum Metric University, and they could do deep dive tutorials, certifications. When they get certified, they could publish it to LinkedIn, and they could basically build this viral loop around education around their product. And so that's a really cool use case on the customer enablement side, where you can actually just enable your customers to be more proficient in your products, and then also help save them from things like churn or low engagement as well.
But and the key to that is Quantum Metrics had to create all that content. They had to create that certification program. They still had to create all that, right? Like, you're just providing the technology to enable the delivery of the content. You guys don't create the content, right?
We have the secret sauce of our platform. And this is when you talk about that startup journey and the differentiators with the 600 competitors, is most of them you would think are like that. It's like, hey, you just import the content like a video you made, or what we call a SCORM file in the education industry, is a prepackaged kind of learning artifact. Okay. What we did different is we actually allow customers to create content on our platform. So think of a Google Docs of training content. So our customers can really easily spin up learning content. So we have the video editing capabilities. We have the ability to have open text. You can have flip cards, test questions. So we have a whole WYSIWYG editor. So that someone who has no idea how to create training content can actually come into the platform, never be classically trained, and go knock out a course for a customer or an internal stakeholder.
So a lot of the competitive products are not really document editors as well. They're not really designed for content creation. They're just meant to host the content.
Yeah, not as much. And so we could do both. We could host content,
yeah,
but our secret sauce is also creating content. And like a pro tip, and this is kind of like when you do your pitches with venture capitalists, what's great is it creates great lock-in in exchange for the value you give to clients.
Right.
And so venture capitalists will always ask, hey, why would a customer not jump from your platform to another? Well, it's because they create a lot of native content on the platform. And that's the give and take. It's like, hey, they can quickly create content, but yes, it's going to be native on the platform itself, which also helps reduce things like switching costs.
Yeah. Well, I want to talk more about your journey after Y Combinator, but before we do that, I do want to remind everybody that finding expert software developers doesn't have to be difficult, especially when you visit fullscale.io, where you can build a software team quickly and affordably. Use the Fullscale platform to define your technical needs and then see what developers are available to join your team. Visit fullscale.io to learn more. So after Y Combinator, I'm going to guess you guys were able to raise some money. But were you able to really ramp up sales, or did you guys
hit a wall there somewhere that was, you know, tough to figure out from a growth perspective.
Yeah, we totally hit that wall. Paul Graham talks about I think he originated the concept, the startup trough of disillusionment. And if you visualize a graph, imagine exponential up and to the right, mini growth when you start, in excitement when you start your startup. And then right after you launch or get that TechCrunch article, you kind of fall off a cliff, and then you linearly grow your startup after the fact. And that's exactly what happened to us. We graduated YC. I think we were listed as like a top 10 company to watch on TechCrunch, had a nice launch, raised that 2.2 I talked about earlier from some world-renowned investors like Alexis Ohanian, Joe Montana, Gary Tan, and a few others. And Sousa Ventures as an example. And then what happened was we just like lost the momentum. We hit every challenge you could think of. We weren't growing fast enough. We didn't really have go-to-market fit, which we could talk about in a little bit. We had great team members, but also we had made some hiring decisions on, and people joined us who probably weren't ready for the startup journey yet. So we had those challenges. We didn't really have a culture defined. So just pretty much every mistake you could hit in the book, which I call it the wandering, the desert years, back half of 2016, all of 2017, first half of 2018, very challenging times, churned through employees, churned through customers. It was a tough time. And that was really mentally taxing on us. Probably could have almost killed the company if we hadn't persevered mentally during that time.
And so you don't think any of that had to do with the product? It was more your go-to-market strategy?
I think it was the combination of the two. I think one kind of begets the other. It's like we just weren't growing. I think that's the ultimate thing, was like we just weren't growing at the expectations of a venture-backed company,
yeah,
right? And so then that causes a lot of discontent with the team, with how you operate together, how you even decide on building things. And so it ultimately stemmed from low growth. Like it's just like, hey, if the growth is not there on the startup journey, that's almost the number one thing in the early days, right? If the growth isn't there, it will pretty much squash anything else you're doing. Like you have a great team, but the growth isn't there, it's going to make everything really hard. And that's essentially that trough of disillusionment, just the growth wasn't there.
So what did you guys do to get that growth going? What was the thing you had to figure out?
Yeah, that was really what I call the journey to go to market fit. And what was interesting was we were in an existing space. So we didn't do anything like category creation. Our space was well-defined, the LMS category. You could literally sign up to a competitor product and know exactly what you need to build and how to improve on it. So that was never the issue. We were building the product in the right way, but we didn't know who to sell to. Like in one given day, I was selling to a trucking company in Chicago. I was then selling to a nursing company in New Hampshire. I was then selling to a biking company in Ecuador. And then on the same day, I was doing on-site at Square, selling to their sales team, right? And so it was just this hodgepodge of customers and personas and use cases. And it made it really difficult for us to hone our pitch or even know what features to specifically focus on over time. And so it took us that time between mid-2016 and mid-2018 to really figure out what's the persona we should sell to. And we looked at the data, we looked at the anecdotal conversations we were having, and we said, you know what? The way to do this is we got to sell to a specific target, under 250 or 300 employees, and let's sell to sales teams and let's sell to tech based in SF. So we got really specific. Mm-hmm. And there was a way that we could actually land into accounts and then grow our brand over time. And that was the secret sauce, was getting to a specific niche of customers to then get momentum to then expand to our long-term platform vision.
Well, and so this is a common problem a lot of startups have. And one of my previous companies had the same problem. It's like when you're trying to sell to everybody, you're almost selling to nobody, right? It's hard to get momentum in any particular area. And so for you guys, was it outbound sales that you were trying to do and trying to really focus the outbound sales on that criteria, where before you were doing outbound sales but kind of just all over the place? Or were you guys doing more inbound sales? Like what was your actual sales process look like?
Yeah, for sure. And I was doing a mix of both. But what was interesting was that the outbound was really where the go-to-market fit did come from. So
okay.
What was happening in those early days, we would do a mix of outbound hard. It was just me, really. And I would go on LinkedIn. I'd call them LinkedIn days. And I would just scour LinkedIn in my network. And what was great about our category, you're kind of just one intro away from the buyer. And it's usually a mid-level to lower-level buyer. So it's not a big ask. You could go ask a friend who you worked with previously, like, hey, can you intro me to your sales enablement leader? And they're like, yeah, sure. That's an easy intro. So that was a lot of our outbound motion. I would say the majority of our initial customers were from there. But when we talk about some of the inbound, we invest a lot in what I call empty calories. We were spending money on paid acquisition, like Capterra, if you've heard of that,
mm-hmm. Yep.
A little bit of SEM as well. And we were getting some of this inbound, like I talked about, like that nursing home, that trucking company, those were all inbound off of these empty calories. And these empty calories would really spin your wheels or get you confused about your go-to-market fit because they were coming inbound. But in reality, you were basically hacking the system and hijacking their clicks. And they're kind of landing at the wrong spot, ultimately, right? Although you don't want to admit it. And so over time, we basically shed those empty calories, did a heavy focus on outbound for that first, let's call it 30 to 50 customers. And then once we got that rolling, then we came back and started investing in more inbound motions. But we built the back of the company off of outbound. And then eventually we built the back of the company off a really great outbound team, BDRs.
Okay, very cool. So I think you mentioned before we started recording that, you know, the kind of 0 to 1 was kind of a slow process. And then the 1 past that kind of took off a rocket. You want to tell us a little more about that?
Yeah, for sure. And they always tell us to entrepreneurs, like, hey, don't give up too early, right? Because you might be right on the cusp. And again, took us about 3 years to get to that first million of ARR, 3 hard years that I just described. But then only a couple quarters to get our next million. And then I think it's about a year and a half or 2 years after that to get to 10 million, right? And so it was a really fast uptick to go from 1 to 10. And the big difference was, hey, once we hit that go-to-market fit, everything started to click, right? Once it starts clicking, then the investors notice. And then, for example, when we got to million ARR, we were then able to raise our A round from our Series A round of 8 million from Bow Capital. Then we took that and parlayed that into the business and hired our executive team and started to invest more in the product. And that led to our B round, which allowed us to raise 17 million from Omer's Ventures. And so it was a nice flywheel effect once you start getting that momentum, right? And so I could talk more about the specific tactics of that momentum from 1 to 10. I think the big part to notice of that journey is a lot like companies like UiPath or Bill.com. Those early years can be hard. Doesn't mean like, hey, it's all doom and gloom. It might just be it's a slow burn to actually get to good product market fit or go-to-market fit. And don't give up before that. And then you can actually take off to the races afterwards.
Well, and something I wanted to ask you about is you talked about in the early days, you struggled to, you know, getting to that first million and that first 3 years were kind of stressful because growth wasn't hitting the expectations that everybody kind of had, right? But do you feel like that those expectations were a lot higher than they should have been or would have been differently if you had been like a bootstrapped company? Like if you guys were bootstrapped, everybody would have been perfectly happy and that extra stress just wouldn't have been there? Or do you feel like the team would have still been like highly disappointed by the growth?
That's a great question, actually. I haven't been asked that maybe ever or in a long time.
I mean, basically it's like the VC part of it adds so much extra pressure that if you hadn't raised the VC, like maybe you guys would have been super happy with the growth that you had and the success that you had, but it's like the VC part of it kind of just really, you know, added the multiple layers of stress on top.
Yeah. You know, I think there's 2 ways to answer that question. The first as a founder, I was just talking to this founder yesterday. He had some really good advice as picking his brain on his new company. And he said, Ted, you need to know in your heart of hearts, like, what do you want out of the company you're building? And it depends on every person, right? And also stage of life. Like, hey, if I said, hey, I want to build a company that generates a lot of cash and have that, and actually grow my wealth through the salary I take from the company, that's a much different version to a person who says, hey, I want to go ring the bell on right. NASDAQ, and this has to be a venture-backed company, right? And so when we started the company, and even to this day, my motivation is really, if I had to sum it up, to be a successful entrepreneur. And when I say in those terms, for me, it means, hey, ringing the bell for WorkRamp, right? Is, hey, taking this to IPO. And so again, it's a lofty goal, but it's the goal that I've set. And so with that then forces you or to your audience, this forces you to think through, hey, what are those pressure points, and be very honest with yourself of how you want to build the business. And so what was really good is those outside factors adding stress actually forced us to work harder, work smarter, hire the right people, look to raise venture capital, which was really stressful in most of those scenarios. And so what I like to say is that, hey, if you choose how you want to run your startup, then two, use those pressures to accelerate your momentum forward, right? And even to this day, it's like, hey, we've now raised Series C. Investors expect you to go public at some point, or at least have a big enough outcome. Right. And so that adds pressure on how you run the company. You will run it in a different way compared to, let's call it, a bootstrap startup right now too. So yeah, great question though.
Well, so when we started the conversation, you said that one of your advantages that you guys thought you had was that you were in Silicon Valley. So fast forward several years now, curious, what do you think about that now? Is being in Silicon Valley yeah. still a advantage? Or, I mean, it looks like you're recording the podcast today. I know nobody can see it, but I can see it, like, maybe from your house. I mean, have you guys went remote? Like, is the company now remote and not really totally. In Silicon Valley anymore? Or just kind of curious?
That's exactly right. So I'm personally in Silicon Valley still. I'm in Redwood City, and we did move 100% remote. Actually, recently, during COVID, we were
right.
technically hybrid remote, still had our office, and a great office in SF, but we just got rid of it. And we're officially 100% remote now. And now I'd almost frame it as I've changed my mindset of hey, you can hire from anywhere now, and you can run remotely, and our company is fully remote, but mostly in the US. I would call it, I think it's 95% in US and Canada. Mm-hmm. But the difference though is we still have a Silicon Valley ethos and mindset to growth and building the company. And so not to say, hey, everyone we're hiring is just around California, because we have people everywhere, but it's more around, hey, we are using the best practices from Silicon Valley venture companies and applying them into the company itself and how we operate. But the people can be from anywhere, right? We've done a great job hiring across the country, as an example, top tier engineering talent. I think you hire talent from all over the world, and we'll probably do that eventually. Right now we've just done a really good job hiring from anywhere, but then having that ethos from our original Silicon Valley roots.
Well, and as a follow-on question to that, you mentioned like being able to hire Silicon Valley engineers. And as a software developer myself from Kansas City, I would never in a million years want to hire from a software developer from Silicon Valley, because they want to get paid like twice as much money, which to me, yes. I can't fathom. So I'm curious if your opinion of that part of it has changed too over the years.
Yeah, that's actually interesting. And I think the world will change, is changing even more before our eyes with obviously the economic downturn. I would say our pay philosophy has been, let's be in the 75 percentile of tech companies and keep an eye on that. But it doesn't really matter the location. So we actually, for example, have equal pay regardless of location right now.
Okay.
We just want to be in that 75th percentile of comparable, let's call it Series C companies. And we also try to compensate well on equity too. Okay. And so you bring up a good point, but that might evolve in the future, right? That's historically what we were doing over the last 2 to 3 years. So we can hire someone in Kansas City at Silicon Valley rates, right? But we did find a lot of the value in those hires. But I could see in the future where even companies like us get more creative, maybe supplement with an offshore team, or maybe hire more internationally at a reduced rate. I think everything's on the table now as all of these tech companies, including us, are reevaluating their expenses, their cost structure, their R&D structure. I think it's all on the table, but historically that was really our philosophy.
Well, I've just always found it to be an interesting conversation as, you know, a CTO and a business owner. And because I always felt like if I was hiring developers in Silicon Valley, of course they're like 40 to 50% more. They're not twice as much. They're like 40 to 50% more. But I also felt like at best I'm hiring the people that are the leftovers from like Google and Facebook and Apple and all these places. And, you know, and it's hard to be the cool company to work for there. Like, you know, you're not the cool company. Where if you come to Kansas City, you can be the cool company. Like WorkRamp could be the cool company and you can stand out from the crowd, right?
Yes.
Versus in Silicon Valley, that's probably impossible, right? You're never going to be the cool company because there's always going to be Twitter and Facebook and Apple and Uber and all these different people.
Yeah, and that's the one thing I learned early on when I talked about how we rotated through people in the early days. And it's not to their fault at all. It's actually more around, if we're talking about market fit, there is an employee market fit, right? And
right.
One big thing we learned in our hiring journey is make sure people opt in. So actually, we don't sell people hard in our recruiting process. We need people who are like, hey, I do not want to go to Google.
Yeah.
I want to go to this early stage startup because that's where I fit in. That's what I want to try. And that was a big learning is, hey, you're probably not chasing after the FANG leftovers. You're chasing after people who maybe just was the top engineer at another YC company that flatlined. And now they need another great YC company to join. That's a perfect engine. Like one of our top engineers is like that. It was one of the top engineers from another YC company who we said, hey, let's get you a new home. And he's been amazing here at WorkRamp.
I actually kind of find it funny to look at the resumes of developers that worked at the FANG companies, which is like Facebook, Apple, Amazon, Netflix, Google, or whatever is what that stands for. People who don't know, I didn't even know what that stood for until a few months ago. But it's funny to look at their like what they did at Google, and they'll be like, I made this one thing 10% faster and I added this one button at Facebook newsfeed or some crap like that. And it's like, that's all they did in like 1 year. It was like,
totally. But they probably got paid $500,000 for that button.
Yeah. Yeah. But, and to that point though, like I would much rather actually go work at WorkRamp and like build something, like actually create something, not add the like one little feature to the Facebook newsfeed or whatever, you know?
Yep. So, yeah, and that's the value prop in our stage. Yep.
Absolutely. I'd much rather work for you guys. You guys would be way cooler in my book, but there's a lot of developers that do get attracted to the FANG thing. Well, if you do need to hire software engineers, testers, or leaders, FullScale can help. We have the people in the platform to help you build and manage a team of experts. When you visit fullscale.io, all you need to do is answer a few questions and let our platform match you with our fully vetted, highly experienced developers. At FullScale, we specialize in building long-term teams that work only for you. You can learn more at fullscale.io. Well, this has been a great conversation, and you know, it's always cool to talk to people who have been through Y Combinator and the whole VC gamut, Silicon Valley gamut. Like, it's a definitely different, totally different than the, you know, the Kansas City vibe.
Totally, for better or for worse.
It's just different, you know, and like, my first company, I bootstrapped the entire way to doing $35 million a year in revenue as a SaaS company.
Wow, amazing.
Never raised a single dollar of investor or of institutional funding. You know, we financed it with Visa and MasterCard, you know.
Oh, that is awesome.
So, you know, there are different paths, right? But that's what Silicon Valley is famous for, as you said, the ethos of that path. And so as we round up the show today, I'm curious if you have any, you know, final like thoughts, tips, you know, words of wisdom for other entrepreneurs out there.
Yeah, to your last comment, I'll actually just close with what you just said is, and given we care so much, or care so much about learning, is always learn from others on the different types of journeys you can take as an entrepreneur. So like even yesterday, I just reached out to that random founder who actually took a slightly different journey. He was on this kind of fast VC path and then went bootstrapped, and he's now back on the VC path. Is learn from others what they've done and try to get a myriad of experiences, people who are like yourself, who have bootstrapped, all the way to people who are running unicorns, all the way to public public CEO founders, right? And get all those perspectives, because you don't know where life's going to take you, and use that to basically influence the decisions you make. And so I think all the journeys are great and they're all different. And the key is, don't keep the blinders on. Always ask and learn from others through this journey, because you will pick up tidbits that you can apply and actually know that, hey, I could fall back in this route, or maybe I should push harder and go for this other route. Great, great way to continue to improve as an entrepreneur.
That's a great, great tip. So many entrepreneurs, we don't know what we don't know. I mean, to me, that's the bottom line. We don't even know what we don't know. And having mentors and advisors is so valuable. So
totally.
Well, once again, this was Ted Blosser from WorkRamp. Their website is workramp.com. For those who are listening, please also, you can join our Facebook group, Startup Hustle Chat. You can find us on Facebook. It's a great group. You can also find me on TikTok and Instagram and all these places. It's Matt Watson KC, or on LinkedIn. So Ted, thank you so much for being on the show today.
Matt, thanks for having me. Excited that we could do this finally.
All right. Thank you, sir.
Startup Hustle's brought to you by Fullscale.io, helping you build a software team quickly and affordably. Make sure you reach down and hit that subscribe button, then come find us on Instagram. See you next time. We do it.